American Literature Pre-Discussion Podcast 3 for Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter, Chapters 1 to 6. Now, I'm going to start this discussion of The Scarlet Letter by confessing I'm feeling guilty because I'm not assigning you the opening introductory chapter called The Custom House. It's I sort of feel the same way about this as I feel about when I give my, you know, daughter a carrot instead of, you know, making her eat Brussels sprouts. I feel kind of guilty about this. Now, they're both good for her, but, you know, aren't parents supposed to make their kids eat healthy? Shouldn't I, as an English professor, make sure that you get a staunch and virtuous diet of the literary greats, without worrying too much about the frosting and sprinkles that today's popular authors heap on their work in order to keep the attention of audiences? I saw on Twitter today that Cory Doctorow, a science fiction author and technology writer, said that books are devices for producing a kind of focused reverie. Now, The Custom House is a long, and at first glance, it seems kind of pointless essay, something that you really would need a lot of focus in order to understand. Now, by the end of the semester, I think we'll all be more skilled at creating that focused reverie, that sort of dream stage of concentration and contemplation where you're really one with the words, where there's a lot of intellectual give and take. With a little more practice reading long-form texts, rather than reading texts that are designed for you to scan and get those keywords and bullet points that somebody else has told you are the most important, with a little bit more of that practice, and that practice, of course, is reading really page after page of prose and making our own decisions about what themes and events in that prose are the most important. After that sort of practice, after that experience, I think the jump from a short story like The Young Goodman Brown to the Custom House essay would be a bit more manageable. A short story has very few characters and a single line of action, no subplots and no unresolved points by the end. Now, by the contrast, The Custom House takes its time. It lingers over the description of some minor characters. It's really more a gallery of sketches of Boston, of a certain class of working men, of Hawthorne's developing identity as a professional writer. It's all those things, rather than a story that you can summarize. So I'm not going to try to summarize it right now. I guess by skipping it, maybe I'm admitting that I just don't want to bother taking the extra time to teach it. And I do feel guilty about that. Hence this confessional. But I do think that jumping into The Scarlet Letter cold, without any knowledge of what happens in The Custom House, kind of distorts the opening and we lose something. There's a kind of fun literary tradition that involves authors coming up with origin stories for the manuscripts that they publish. The Custom House is one of these stories. It sets the stage for Hawthorne handing the manuscript or the story that came to him from a manuscript onto us for us to make our judgment. He gives some social satire, some humorous portraits of these aging, withered, dried-up clerks who work or allegedly work in the Custom House. They're sort of useless and cheerful and unambitious, dried-up men who take home a modest salary for almost no work. Really, Rip Van Winkle would have loved it in the Custom House. But even a comparatively big city like Boston in the Custom House seems to us like a sleepy hick town. We do learn a bit about how Hawthorne justifies the act of writing at an age when writing wasn't really a profession. He has to sort of elaborately tell his audience just how bored he was at the Custom House and that he had nothing better to do to occupy his time but write. So here we're seeing a towering figure of the American literary scene. The American Renaissance is the term for the sort of outburst of American literary creation that Hawthorne is closely associated with. But we have this towering figure of American literary history apologizing to his readers for actually spending the time doing something as useless as honing his craft when he could have been doing something productive. Now, I say Hawthorne, but the I of the Custom House essay is at least partially fictionalized, and whenever we come across an I in a story, in literature class, certainly, we can never be sure whether the I and the author are one and the same. So, in general, I would assume, don't assume that the I and the author are the same. But this the essay is clearly, the essay really shows Hawthorne describing his own development as an author. So I'll just take a shortcut and call this speaker Hawthorne, as I think most scholars do. But Hawthorne, as he gets ready to introduce his main narrative, invokes this literary convention that we are to trust the authority of the author, or at least pretend to keep our minds open long enough that we can reflect and absorb this story that he's about to dive into and give us. As he builds up to the story, he describes his discovery in an abandoned attic of a manuscript along with a strange artifact, a finely crafted cloth, capital letter A. I'll read a bit. It had been intended, there could be no doubt, as an ornamental article of dress. But how it was to be worn, or what rank, honor, and dignity in bypassed times were signified by it, was a riddle which I saw little hope of solving. And yet it strangely interested me. I'm trimming a bit for time, by the way. He goes on to say, I happened to place it on my breast. It seemed to me, the reader may smile, but must not doubt my word, it seemed to me then that I experienced a sensation not altogether physical, yet almost so, as of burning heat. And as if the letter were not of red cloth, but red-hot iron, I shuddered and involuntarily let it fall upon the floor. So here we see Hawthorne is suggesting a supernatural explanation for an unusual fact. But he leaves open the possibility, it's just his imagination. He says it's like heat. It's not quite heat, it's a sensation almost like heat. We see this pattern frequently in Hawthorne, and indeed it's a convention of the romance genre. The truly exceptional, heroic women and men are the ones whose emotions cannot be contained by ordinarily physical laws. Their feelings just burst out of the physical realm and into the supernatural. To expect a rational, logical explanation for what great lovers do is unfairly limiting to the unusual, rare creatures, these unusual souls, these creatures blessed and cursed with a soul that's too good for this world. The story of finding the manuscript and the scarlet letter itself in a box reminds Hawthorne's original audience that the story is set well in the past. Hawthorne was writing about a Puritan New England that, by the mid-1800s, no longer existed. So, we should not confuse the fictional Puritans in the Scarlet Letter with any real historical people. So we can't use the Scarlet Letter to try to make a theological point about the Puritan faith, for example. Neither should we confuse the setting of the novel and the values of the community depicted in the novel with the setting of Hawthorne's life and the values of Hawthorne and his community. Chapter 1 starts out by describing bearded men in sad-colored garments and gray steeple-crowned hats. Notice that colored has the British U in there in the spelling. Okay, because Chapter 1 starts off by describing these bearded, dreary guys, naturally this colorful ornament that we've just seen near the end of the prologue seems like it belongs to a different story. Now, I like bringing up the symbolism of the rose bush outside the prison door as an example of a detail that trips students up. It's a detail that students expect me to tell them what it means, the way kids are told what 6 times 6 is, or what the capital of Iceland is. They're told to memorize it and spit it back. Now, of course, a rose is red, and the scarlet letter is also red, and the rose is a symbol of passion, and the scarlet letter is a symbol of passion, too, and oh my gosh, the scarlet letter causes suffering just like a rose has thorns. Who can really argue with any of that? It's not an interpretation if you just propose a meaning for something or you just look at one-to-one associations. Now, an interpretation is something that will provoke a discussion and maybe drive you back to the texts to read it again in a new light. But I think, gosh, the rose is red and the scarlet letter is red. It's not really a discussion of interpretation or possible meanings. It's just kind of a thing that makes you go, huh. Now, maybe if you point out that the rose is at the threshold of the prison door, and you note that in Young Goodman Brown, we first see Faith's pink ribbons at the threshold of her house, and the word threshold appears in both cases, and maybe if you look really carefully at the function of the pink ribbon in Young Goodman Brown and the function of the scarlet letter, you might find some interesting parallels. But it's not enough to say there is a lot of symbolism in Nathaniel Hawthorne's work. Among the symbols in his work are pink ribbons and a scarlet letter. That's a very general, pretty weak claim. You're just claiming there is symbolism in Nathaniel Hawthorne. Now, do we need to prove that? It's like saying Nathaniel Hawthorne's novels include vowels. Right, I'm glad you noticed that. That's great. But it's a starting point. We don't stop there. What does he do with these vowels, with these symbols, that surprises us or gives us something new to talk about? So literary analysis can be a bit more intellectually engaging if we ask ourselves a question that does not have an obvious answer. For instance, in class last week, I raised the possibility that Rip Van Winkle, far from being a selfish layabout, actually shows some altruistic, nurturing behavior, often enough that he's actually a better caregiver and role model in the community than his wife is. And is Dame Van Winkle being intolerant for trying to force her husband, and then later her son, out of the house, out of the kitchen, and into the role of breadwinner, when Rip Van Winkle actually shows skills that would make him a better homemaker? Now, I can imagine intelligent people disagreeing with me on that topic, and I can imagine us going back to the text and really sort of weighing the evidence in favor of one and in favor of the other. It's a better discussion topic, just discussion starter, than Rip Van Winkle sees many changes after he wakes up, and then a paragraph where you describe what it was like before he fell asleep, and a paragraph where you describe what it was like after he fell asleep. Well, what do you do with that? Okay. My wife says she once had a great class discussion about Young Goodman Brown when someone asked whether the old man's staff could be a phallic symbol. Go back and read the story and look at how the characters interact with the staff. You know, the old lady wants to grab it at one point. Does that give you a new insight? Is the only way to look at the staff a phallus? Could it also mean something else? Does it mean different things at different times in the story? Do we have to see it as a phallus at all? What good does it do to our understanding of the story to see it as a phallus? Okay, returning now to the Scarlet Letter. I don't deny that Hawthorne insists that the rose outside the prison door is important, but he wants us to see the implausibility of hope, but it's there. It's just the surprising resilience of beauty and ornamentation that endures even in bleak surroundings. So we can look and see what happens to the rose bush. We don't see it trampled under the boots of the unfeeling authorities as they build an extension to the prison house. That would be too symbolic. We don't see the rose bush lying on someone's grave in the opening scene. We don't see a rose clenched in the teeth of a young lover as he climbs onto a balcony. There are some things that we don't see. We do see the rose bush on what Hawthorne calls the threshold of our narrative. And I would say that, though the chapter does not give us enough information to decide whether things will turn out well for Hester or whether they'll turn out poorly, Hawthorne tells us at one point, he addresses the reader, we could hardly do otherwise than pluck one of its flowers and present it to the reader. It may serve, let us hope, to symbolize some sweet moral blossom that may be found among the track, or relieve the darkening close of a tale of human frailty and sorrow. Hawthorne is never subtle, and here he presents some possible meanings of the rose. Will it be a sweet moral blossom, or will it simply relieve a dark tale? Hawthorne presents these options to the reader. Now, we could spend some time looking for evidence in favor of the rose being a sweet moral blossom, and we could look for evidence in favor of the rose being a relief to a tale of frailty and sorrow, but if we did, I think we'd be missing the point. First of all, just because Hawthorne gives us these two options does not mean that we have to choose one or the other. That would be limiting. Now, particularly in the romance genre, where you're not supposed to have to choose like that, one possible meaning does not necessarily exclude the other. Even more important, I think, is not literally what the rosebush means, but rather the fact that Hawthorne is ending the opening chapter with this open note. He's inviting the reader to decide, to predict, to participate at least in some manner, in the construction of the meaning of his story. This is part of that literary magic that creates that focused reverie, that moment of being in the zone where you're interacting deeply with the text. There's a give and a take. Without getting us to try to remember a commercial jingle or trying to get us to tune in this time next week, a novel builds a world for us to inhabit. The novel is the genre in which we have the luxury of time to get into somebody else's psychology. And we have to work to make this happen. In practical terms, for this class, that means careful reading and rereading. Not reading the way you skim to absorb content, but reading to reflect and really mentally construct the world with the raw materials that this author shows us so that we can participate in this simulation. So remember, Hawthorne's original audience would already have been 200 years distant from the Puritan culture depicted in this story. Writing in the 1800s, Hawthorne lived in an America that celebrated the protection of the freedom of religion by enforcing the separation of church and state. That's the same America we live in. Yet Chapter 2 mentions that this community scoured Quakers, and it described people among whom religion and law were almost identical. This explains why the whole town would bother to come out in order to watch the shaming of an adulteress. Hawthorne is carefully explaining to his reader that these people are different from you and me. And when we see those cues, the message is the same for us. They are different from us. Now, at this particular point in the story, so far we've only indirectly gotten to know Hester by Chapter 2, but as we do, our 21st century values may leave us shocked at the encounter with these male authority figures who punish Hester this way. Of course, the author wants us to be shocked that the law and religion is treating Hester this way. Hawthorne has created a bleak and unfeeling environment precisely so that readers will rally to Hester's defense. And he's not above exaggerating and oversimplification in order to make the reader sympathize with his heroine. But let's analyze this sort of gut-level, knee-jerk reaction a bit. Is Hester really a victim of the patriarchy? We got these sad, gray men, yes, but Chapter 1 goes out of its way to mention that there are women among the crowd of sad-clothed men. And Chapter 2 carefully establishes that the women of the community have also passed judgment on Hester. And their judgment, in many ways, matches the official judgment of the male law and the male-dominated religion. One of the five women offers some sympathy, but the oldest woman, the elder, the one who's supposed to be, you know, the wisest, cries out harshly that the punishment is not severe enough. So this makes the men seem kind by comparison, because the women, or at least this one woman, they're calling for Hester to be killed for her crimes. The religious leaders, by contrast, speak of Hester's soul, not just her sin. So when you look at it that way, Hawthorne is painting a fairly complex picture. As soon as we see that the only reason Hester is standing up there alone is not because the community doesn't want to punish the man, who's equally guilty, but for reasons that we haven't been told yet, Hester has chosen not to name the father of her baby. Had she named the father, we can be darn sure he would be up there shamed just as she's being shamed, and we would not have this image of this entire community ganging up on poor Hester. Hawthorne carefully isolates Hester. He's not doing it because he's a cruel man who enjoys oppressing women. He's doing it because he's created a fictional woman in order to make a point about, okay, well, if I told you what I thought the point of the novel was, I'd be giving too much away. But I do think I can say that we can assume Hawthorne wants to make a point. Chase your characters up trees and then throw rocks at them. That's the advice creative writing instructors give, and that's how you engage the audience. You make the audience want the protagonist to persevere. You make them... We want to think that their life is unfair. We want the bad stuff to stop. Hawthorne is throwing a lot of bad stuff at Hester because he has to establish that she's tough enough to handle it. Hester would not be the awesome character that she is if she lived in a forgiving community. My wife once pointed out to me, though, that the women in Salem actually have a good reason to be so angry at Hester. Because she has not named the father of the baby, every wife in that town will have this tiny sliver of doubt, wondering, was it my husband who did it? And every man will have to endure the suspicious looks of the women as they think to themselves, was it you? Hester could ease a lot of tension in this community and make a lot of people's lives more harmonious if she just spoke up. But she chooses not to. At the end of chapter 2, we see two strangers arrive. One's an Indian, and one's Hester's presumed dead husband. The fact that the husband looks like a wild man and also has one shoulder higher than the other identifies him as, you know, emissaries from the outside. They're strangers. They're outsiders. They're not part of this community. In those days, the wilderness was really just a short walk from the village center. But it's a reminder here just how fragile civilization was and really how threatened city dwellers can feel by this vastness around them and the strangeness of the sort of heathen ways. There's a new subfield in literary studies, not 10 years old, maybe 15 years old, that looks at how disability is represented in literature. Now, every kid is trained by Disney to know that the guy with the scar and the limp is the bad guy. And we use words like blind and deaf or crippling as metaphors for stupidity and indifference and, you know, problems getting things done. The deformity of this stranger that we meet in Chapter 2, this deformity does not serve any plot point. I mean, he's not hiding secret incriminating documents in a fake hump. We're meant to take his physical deformity as a hint of moral deformity. Now, this is not fair, but this is a convention of the literature. We'll see this again when Hawthorne notes that the baby is completely healthy and beautiful despite her origin, and he seems to be surprised, or at least he seems to expect the audience would be surprised by that. I'm not going to go any further into disability studies now, but if you are interested, it is a recent example of how we can take a new idea, this idea of including members of different abilities in society instead of institutionalizing them, how we can take a new idea, a new value, and use that value to reread all the classic old stories, to see why scholars keep returning to these great old stories with new things to say. Well, we soon learn this stranger isn't just a wild man. He's a man of science. He's from the old world. He's somehow finagled a marriage with the young Hester. Since everyone knows Hester was married, I presume Hester Prynne is her married name, and the stranger must be Mr. Prynne. I don't think any scholars will call him that. He does take the name Chillingworth, and that's how he's known. Chillingworth. Ooh, the name Chillingworth. Please don't write a paper on the symbolism of the names in the Scarlet Letter. We know the guy's name is not Dr. Happy McCheerfulberry. We know his name is not Mr. Bygones Be Bygones. His name is Chillingworth. And the baby's Pearl. We get it. Okay, there's a deep intensity in the interview between Hester and Chillingworth. Hawthorne's audience would have thought that the language of prithee and thou was old-fashioned, but the words thee and thou are really terms of endearment. You don't call a stranger thou, you'd say you. Chillingworth says the child is yours. He's using you, which is a formal, distant word. But Hester says, wouldst thou avenge thyself on the innocent babe? The thou and the thy are the familiar terms. Now, later in the scene, we see both characters are using those familiar terms, but I do think it's significant that Hawthorne carefully put the word yours in a sentence in which Chillingworth rejects the baby. That's a careful word choice that you might not notice if you're not aware of the significance of that language, or that particular word. In Chapter 5, Hester at her needle, we see Hester settling into her new life on the fringes of society. She's withdrawn but proud, she's charitable but aloof, she's both a symbol of guilt and a model of martyrdom. She's a very complex character, and that's why she's, I think, worth study. Later, Hawthorne tells us in that chapter women derive a pleasure incomprehensible to the other sex from the delicate toil of the needle. Now, maybe you agree with that and maybe you don't, but Hawthorne isn't really interested in making a point about needlework. He's not interested in whether you agree with him or not. He's using that detail to make a point about Hester's industry, suggesting that she could have used her talents only on the finest products and she would have enjoyed it, but she chose to spend much of her time making garments for the poor. And Hawthorne says, it is probable that there was an idea of penance in this mode of occupation. So Hawthorne points out that Hester could have left Salem and started a new life somewhere else. She could have pretended to be a widow, made a good life with her needle, but if she did leave, we wouldn't have this story. In order to have this story, Hawthorne has to explain why Hester stays put. And he feels, anyway, that the detail of Hester feeling that she needs to give up joy in order to do penance, in order to pay for a crime, well, that detail reminds us that Hester is not a product of 21st century culture. Now, she's not a product of Puritan New England either, because she's a product of Hawthorne's imagination. She's not a real woman. She's a representation of a woman. She goes along with Hawthorne's fictional representation of Puritan New England. That representation of Puritan New England can't tell us anything at all about the real Puritan faith or our study of Hester, the character, cannot tell us anything about the historical treatment of women in New England in the 1600s, any more than a country song can tell us how to raise cattle, or movies about college can tell college students how to study for tests. We can, however, when we look at the literature of our past, study what myths we created in that literature. What older myths are we debunking or altering or supplanting and so forth? Okay, with that, I'm going to point out that, yes, the baby is fascinated by the Scarlet Letter. And Hester dresses her daughter in red, just like the Scarlet Letter. I get it. Please don't write a paper on that. And the minister's name is Dimmesdale. A dale is a valley, and Dimmesdale doesn't seem to be getting much brighter. His name is Arthur Dimmesdale. He's not Chad Brightpeak or Rod Thrustmount. I get it. His name is Dimmesdale. Certainly names are important, and we can have some Freudian fun exploring the implications like I just did. But really, there aren't any surprises in these names. And students who've explored the names can really sometimes run out of steam pretty quickly unless they find something surprising to say. Now, we're wrapping up the pre-discussion podcast in about a minute. I want to leave plenty for you to think about on your own, so I'm just going to bring up Hester's line from Chapter 4. Thy acts are like mercy, but thy words interpret thee as terror. Hester points out that things are not as they may seem. I'm also going to ask you to look at who smiles in this section of the book, and when and why. You can use the search feature in iBooks and look for smile, and look for variations like smiling and smiles. See, what do you come up with? I don't want to give the impression that looking for smiling in the Scarlet Letter is the correct way to approach it. It's not the right answer for you to write down. But I am hoping to invite you to practice collecting evidence and building a theory. Just in science, you get a hypothesis, you create a test, you gather evidence, and you figure out whether you need to change your hypothesis. Well, our test is not just reading about our literary works, but the test is the writing. Our laboratory in the English classroom is the essay. The paragraphs in which you commit to an argument and you marshal the evidence and you collect that evidence and you place it there to see what happens, that is the laboratory that we are using in this classroom. I could give you all those answers, but unless you practice formulating the questions and looking for evidence, then you won't get much use out of those answers. That wraps up the pre-discussion podcast number 3 for American Literature 1 at Seton Hill University. Happy reading, and I'll see you in class.